You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
The NL West is starting to take shape as we enter 2016. Hi, I'm Allison Footer. As we look at all of the teams, not a whole lot is being done at this point. The Dodgers are still trying to figure out their rotation and if it's going to be an all-lefty rotation, whereas the Diamondbacks are pretty happy with what they have with their additions to their rotation. And, of course, the Giants made a lot of free agent signings, a lot of splashes, and they're hoping that their rotation can also keep up with the rest of the division. So we checked in with all five reporters. Let's hear what they had to say. Ken, I want to talk overall about what everyone else is talking about with the Dodgers rotation and that it looks to be largely left-handed. But they might be mixing in a right-handed pitcher in there with the Japanese pitcher Kenta Maeda on a very long deal. So instead of me trying to figure all this out, why don't you tell us what you know about where this is going with this deal for this pitcher?
Well, I think as we learned with Iwakuma, we don't know anything until it's official, and this isn't official. Making it even more difficult to analyze is that there's only been bits and pieces about the supposed agreement that have come out, that it could range anywhere from 3 to 8 years with a guarantee of $24 to $25 million on up with a lot of incentives. So it's clearly a very unusual contract. You're dealing with an unusual team and an unusual front office, so that's not a big surprise. But again, until it's done, it's not done, and we learned that earlier in the offseason with Iwakuma. So they already tried to get a right-handed Japanese pitcher, and that didn't work. So we just got to wait for an official announcement. In lieu of that, you know, what they're doing now is they've had to kind of take the leftovers. The big names are gone, and they got Scott Kazmir. They tried to get Iwakuma, but they didn't like his physical. Now they're with Maeda, it appears, and they're just loading up on quantity at this point, having lost, you know, the quality in Zach Greinke. And I guess they just figured the way the pitchers go down that you just can't have too many starters, especially this team. So they're hoarding them. They're stockpiling them if they all pass their physicals.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting just when I was looking at some of the information on Maeda. 6 feet tall, 154 pounds. So he's a little guy. Finesse pitcher. He's not going to overpower you. He throws a fastball in the low 90s. So it's a little bit of a different look from some of these other guys, which I guess is okay when you're trying to mix it up a little bit.
Well, I also think that's probably why they're able to get him. It's a unique situation in that he apparently wanted to stay on the West Coast to be closer to Japan. And also he has that knock of being a small right-hander, which I think scared away, quite a few other teams that might have been in on him. And so at the end, I don't think his market was as robust as he probably had hoped. And then you had the Dodgers there who were kind of running out of options anyway and wanted a right-hander, and there weren't very many left. So it kind of lined up that they may not have been each other's first pick, but they kind of lined up that they were their logical pick, and so that's the way it seems to have played out.
Yeah, I read somewhere in a column that was written about all of this that the Dodgers may have a logjam in their starting rotation, and I completely disagree with that word because having more starters than the five slots in January is not a logjam. Usually, you're going to need 7-8 starting pitchers, if not more, and given the Dodgers' issue that they've had health-wise, I don't think you could ever call this a logjam. But it's interesting about Kazmir because I was kind of scratching my head when this first came up. They signed him and with an opt-out after 1 year, which I sort of giggled at a little bit, thinking, what is the point of this? But it sort of makes sense. Kind of on both sides. Just the fact that, I guess from Kazmir's standpoint, next year's free agent pitching class is going to be thin, so it sort of gives him a little bit of leverage to maybe be able to get something a little better next year. And then the Dodgers have some pitchers coming up, right? So if they don't necessarily have room for him, then it might work out for both sides. Is that sort of the thinking there?
No, that may have been their thinking. Yeah. You know, it seems like. I mean, I don't know how a player opt out ever can help a team.
Because, right.
You know, the only reason he wouldn't opt out is if he couldn't get a better deal elsewhere, which means he hasn't been pitching very well. So, you know, to me, a player, just like a team option always is in favor of the team, the player opt out is always in favor of the player. That said, you know, Kazmir has really had several different careers, and right now he's on a good part of his career. You know, he's had really bad parts of his career and hadn't had a job and had to pitch in independent ball, but right now he's going well. He does have some physical issues, but you know how many pitchers don't. I think again the Dodgers kind of took the best of what was left, but in truth they really did have to take leftovers because their top picks, you know, they didn't wind up with not only Greinke, but you know, whether they were going to go for David Price, if not David Price, Jordan Zimmermann. All of them were gone, you know, once the Greinke thing fell apart, and then they were left to scramble. And so in scrambling, you know, I think they felt like they got the best pitchers that were available in Kazmir and Maeda. But, you know, to a certain extent, well, Maeda is definitely unproven in the major league, and Kazmir, you know, he's had his ups and downs. You've got Fred Anderson, who's had one – he's coming off his first healthy – year since 2009. You've got Ryu coming off surgery and McCarthy coming off surgery. You know, there's a lot of question marks here with this rotation, and no wonder they feel like they need more than five.
Chris, I want to start off. Number one, I have a question for you. You covered Jeff Kent, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I actually did not.
You did not. Okay, so he was not there when you were coming. But, of course, we are all familiar with his career. Are you surprised that he is not receiving more support than Hall of Fame voting?
Yes, Allison, I'm extremely surprised. He compares extremely well with any of the top second basemen, any Hall of Fame second baseman, you know, who played the game. And it boggles my mind that people don't think he's a Hall of Famer. I've got a couple friends, one who actually played Major League Baseball, and I asked them, you know, is Jeff, while we're sitting around at lunch, you know, is Jeff Kent a Hall of Famer? And they go, heck no. And I'm thinking, what's wrong with you guys? You know, and why do you feel so strongly about this? And why do apparently other people feel strongly that he's not a Hall of Famer? And yet he's hit more home runs. I mean, he had a better career offensively than you could say Ryan Sandberg. And you know, everybody said, "Oh, well, Ryan Sandberg is you know, definitely a Hall of Famer." Blah blah blah, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, some people can argue, well, Jeff Kent hit either in front or behind Barry Bonds for, you know, a 6-7-8 year period. Well, after Kent left San Francisco, he was still productive. He was productive on his own, hitting on his own, in a vacuum. So, you know, he hit well in the hitters. Sure, he went to Houston, a hitter's park, hit well there. But he hit well at Dodger Stadium also. So, that one confuses the heck out of me.
So, is that the reason, though? I mean, is that the main reason that people give you is just because of where he was hitting in relation to Bonds? Is that the main knock on him?
No, I don't get any good reasons.
Okay.
I just don't. So I think they just, it's one of those, you know, I know a Hall of Famer when I see one type of things. And, you know, and frankly, I kind of go, you know, you go by instinct. Sometimes you go by instinct, you know, as a voter, and I'll admit I've done the same thing. You know, I know a Hall of Famer when I see one, that sort of thing. I know we get criticized for thinking that way, but a lot of times. But, you know, I think he's – I mean, I know I didn't cover him, you know, on the teams I covered, but I sure saw a lot of games he played. And to me, he was a quantum leap above any other player in his position for a long, long time.
Yeah, we should note
me,
that.
That's a Hall of Famer for me.
The ballots that have been made public, and I should give a shout-out to at not Mr. Tibbs, who is the only person in this universe who is tracking every single ballot that has been made public. Jeff Kent has received 16.3% of the votes on the public ballot, which is 27 votes, which is not that many. And you wonder, I mean, is there something to be said for a guy that played, like, that's a great player on a bad team, like a Ryan Sandberg? Not taking anything away from Ryan Sandberg because he was a great player. But it's like, oh, you know, he kind of defined the 80s, and he's like, you know, the Cubs, and he was very visible playing on awful teams. And Jeff Kent sort of blended in and just helped a lot of great teams be great. It's not really a shock that he was in as many postseasons as he was in. And maybe that he just sort of gets lost in the shuffle a little bit, and he's not, like, in the forefront of people's minds.
I think he has gotten lost in the shuffle, and maybe that's the best explanation as far as to why he has not received more votes. There were so many great superstar players, such as his teammate Barry Bonds, you know, throughout his era. I mean, he was overshadowed. Maybe they played other positions, but that still overshadowed Jeff. I don't think people realized what kind of hitter he was. I mean, he was a productive hitter. He was a clutch hitter. He's exceedingly good in the clutch. And no, he wasn't sparkling in the field, but he got the job done, and he sure was tough. So again, I'm just befuddled. I don't think he's going to benefit. He didn't spend his whole career with the Giants. I think if he had, the Giants might launch a campaign for him, but I don't think they're, you know, I doubt that they will, you know, when the time comes 2 or 3 years from now when Kent's candidacy is on his last leg. So he's just going to have to hope that enough people realize, hey, this guy really was, worthy of Cooperstown.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that he's at least worthy of more than 16.3% of the voting body. But, okay, so we'll move on from there. You have made your Hall of Fame ballot public, so we will go over it right now. I like it. Okay, so Jeff Bagwell, Ken Griffey Jr., Trevor Hoffman, Jeff Kent, Mike Piazza, Tim Raines, Curt Schilling, Lee Smith, Alan Trammell. So I guess my question to you, we don't need to, you know, give reasons for every guy. Did you struggle? Let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So you voted for 9 guys. So you didn't use the 10 limit. But was there anyone that you were kind of going back and forth on and decided not to vote for or did vote for after careful consideration?
I went back and forth on Curt Schilling a little bit. And I'll admit the postseason – his postseason performance, that kind of tipped the scales in his favor. The posts having, giving it some further thought, having covered as many postseason games as I have, I thought he belonged in there.
Corey, let's talk a little bit about what might be going on with the Padres in the shortstop situation. Ian Desmond, I keep hearing his name coming up, that the Padres might be favorites to get him. What do you know about what's going on with that?
Allison, yeah, I think it's a real possibility. After a pretty quiet December, which is unusual for A.J. Preller, giving his short pass with the Padres, didn't really do anything, but I think they're going to they have at least one big move left in them. How you quantify big depends on your viewpoint, I guess. But, yeah, their biggest need is shortstop, and I think Ian Desmond is a guy that kind of checks off a lot of boxes for them, a guy that's been pretty durable and dependable, a guy that has some home run power. He could help provide some offense in addition to, making all the plays defensively. And, they have to replace Justin Upton's bat. This is a guy that led the team in home runs last year, drove in 70-plus runs. They got to find a way to generate some offense with the returning guys and also, plug a few holes. So I think Desmond is probably a nice fit because, he could play short, he could play some third. I think he could even play some outfield in a pinch if he needed to. Really kind of the perfect NL player. But, yeah, shortstop's a big spot for them, Allison. They've used 18 different guys since 2009. I know we've talked about that. But Mm-hmm. They would like to maybe lock someone in there. It's such a critical position, maybe one of the most important positions on the field.
Yeah, and there's not a huge market for shortstops. Is that, I mean, can the Padres be dealing from strength there? Since Desmond, I mean, if he's trying to, like, set a market for himself or gain some leverage, I don't know that there's a ton of it out there. Is that something that maybe the Padres were, like, would give them the strategy to maybe wait a little bit before they make a move to sign him?
Well, I think, you know, Desmond being a free agent, you know, and also now remember they're going to have to give up a draft pick for him because the Nationals made him a qualifying offer. So this would their first-round pick is eighth overall, so that's protected. So this would essentially be their second-round pick they'd have to give up. So, and certainly they're probably going to have to overpay a little bit. So, you know, and it's kind of a tough one because they had this young kid, Javier Guerra, who they picked up from the Red Sox in the Craig Kimbrell deal. He's probably a couple years away. So, you know, I don't think you want to go 5 years or maybe even 4 years with Ian Desmond. But if you can get him on a three-year deal, I think that looks attractive. You know, they've added some pieces to their farm system. And I know, Allison, we talked about the guys that got back from the Red Sox in the Kimbrell deal. So they've added some assets, and certainly they could move some assets to get a shortstop, too, if they look at the trade market. And, you know, any number of guys could be available there. But in terms of free agent shortstops, yeah, the list is pretty small. You could probably count the guys on one hand minus a few fingers. So I think Desmond will probably get paid pretty well. It remains to be seen if the Padres, how much they'll fork over, though.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of going back to just the offense a little bit. I know you touched on it, but, I mean, it can't be overstated that they need offense. It's something that really can't – I don't think they can go in the season without addressing it a little bit. And you just don't know what you're going to get from somebody who's unproven. So that's got to be a selling point for them, doesn't it?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And, you know, this is a guy with a track record. Now, you look at Desmond's numbers over the last couple of years, you know, his strikeout rate's up, you know, and his ground ball rate isn't sort of trending in the wrong direction. But, you know, I think there is a proven history there, and then maybe a change of scenery will maybe help him. You know, we've always talked about the big ballpark here, Allison, but I think in 2015 the ballpark played pretty darn close to neutral, at least more so than it has since I've been covering the team. 2007. So I think they feel like Desmond's power will probably play in the ballpark, and a guy that sort of fits in the middle of the order, not someone that can wholly replace Justin Upton, because I think that's hard to do, but it can sort of help there. And again, the most critical thing here, I think, it still is the defense and being able to lock someone in at that position and not worry about them and not have to worry about reaching your farm system or trying to sign some minor league free agents in June. That's a real slippery slope. So I think, you know, this would be a guy that could, you know, be their answer at shortstop, and then you can move on to filling some other needs.
Yeah, I'm totally, like, on board with you now, now that we've been doing these for a while and the ballpark playing fair. Like, I've bought into that because of you. Because I've always thought of the Padres ballpark as anything but playing fair on both sides. Definitely not a hitter's ballpark. But it used to, like, in my years of covering the Astros, like, I mean, Minute Maid Park actually played pretty fair, but it was, like, known as a bandbox for the first couple seasons, and it never really, that label just kind of followed them all the way through the years. And so I believe you, Corey, that ballpark does play fair. I am, like, resigning myself to that notion. Are you proud?
But it's hard to wrap your head around a little bit. And I think it will still always kind of have a reputation as a pitcher's ballpark, just because, you know, the dimensions and all that a little bit. But, you know, they have made several fence modifications. You know, last year they put up that big fancy new scoreboard in left field, the largest scoreboard, video board, whatever they want to call it, the National League. There was a real absence of that marine layer. So there were some atmospheric conditions, I think, that played into last year. And I don't know if that's repeatable or what will happen, but, you know, balls that were really cut down on in April and May, Allison, you know, those night games, we didn't see that last year. And maybe it's just, the players. You know, Justin Upton made this ballpark look pretty small at times. And unfortunately for the Padres, so did a lot of other opposing hitters. So we'll see where this goes. But I think, you know, one of the biggest things with the ballpark, and I've tracked this pretty closely, is the players are no longer really complaining about it anymore. Like in the front office, I've talked to some guys, and they kind of make their way through the clubhouse and ask around a little bit, and I end up hearing rumblings that players are no longer complaining about the ballpark. They feel like if they hit a ball, if they really run into it, really square it up, then it's going to go.
Just for the record, I want to note that you said atmospheric. That's such a great word. Thank you for using that. We don't use a lot of big words in baseball. We're baseball nerds. So I want to move on to Trevor Hoffman in the Hall of Fame. So as we are speaking right now, Trevor Hoffman, on the amount of public ballots, he has 62% of the votes on the ballots that have been made public. So it doesn't look like he's going to be getting in. But I don't know why I thought he was like a shoo-in for the Hall of Fame, but there seems to be some writers who don't believe that he's a shoo-in for the Hall of Fame. But then he'll get in eventually. So how do you react to, let's say he ends up with 60% of the vote? How would you react to that? Would you think that's fair?
Yeah, trying to look at it objectively, I'd say I think that's a pretty good number for his first year on the ballot. I guess I never, I don't know if I'd really spend any time thinking about him as an automatic first ballot Hall of Famer. I think that's just such a hard that's a real small company, I think. And, I think he's going to get in. I think he'll get in next year. You get a lot of people arguing the merits of the save, and I get it. Hey, I completely get it. But this guy was really good for a long period of time. He has the numbers to show it. Billy Wagner, same thing. I mean, he didn't have the tenure that Trevor did, but, the strikeouts per nine were better. I think he deserves to be in. So, I think these guys are going to get in. I think Trevor, he may fall short, but I think it's going to happen. And I think the biggest thing, my biggest takeaway from all of this, Allison, is I don't hear anyone saying Trevor Hoffman doesn't belong in the Hall of Fame. It's just that, hey, maybe it's just not going to happen this first year. But I definitely think there's a place for him in Cooperstown.
Steve, I think that it's not so much the Diamondbacks haven't done anything as we look into the new year, because clearly they had a crazy good offseason. But I have a feeling that 7 weeks from now, when we are still doing these podcasts, that we are going to largely be talking about the same team that we're looking at now as going into spring training. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so, Allison. It's certainly, they fooled me before. I didn't have them signing Zach Greinke either as a free agent, so I'm always hesitant now to be too strong on my predictions when it comes to them. But it certainly sounds like for right now, that the roster they have is going to be the roster that they open spring training with. And, wow, 7 weeks, as you said, it's coming up on us pretty quick.
Yeah. I just reading Dave Stewart's quotes, and, clearly he's not just sitting back and crossing his arms and saying, nobody talk to me anymore. But at the same time, they're not going to do anything that's going to be detrimental down the road. The main thing is that they don't want to give up any more picks to sign free agents. And so while we keep hearing Howie Kendrick's name coming up as being in discussions with the Diamondbacks, it would seem that it would be almost counterproductive, really, to kind of hamper your draft that much just for the sake of getting some experience on the roster.
Yeah, I think so, Allison. And when I asked him about it, he said, well, we're not going to give up that pick. And it sounded like they did like Howie Kendrick, but, not at the price in terms of what it would cost them. They've already given up their first overall pick, which is 13th overall in the draft, to sign Zach Greinke, and they really don't want to then give up their second pick, which I believe is a competitive balance round A pick, and then be without their first two draft picks. So it doesn't sound like that's going to happen. It sounds more like what they're going to count on is some of the younger players like Chris Owings and Nick Ahmed, Jake Lamb, Yasmani Tomas, all of those guys kind of stepping up with a little bit of improvement to make up for the loss offensively of Ender Inciarte, who went to Atlanta in the Shelby Miller deal.
Yeah, that was my next point. I mean, adding offense, it doesn't seem to be – it was not really a priority for the Diamondbacks at all, and it doesn't really need to be. Runs were plenty last year, and of course, like you said, they do need to figure out some ways to plug in some runs here and there for what was lost. But they have to feel pretty decent about, you look at the way that the Diamondbacks performed in the second half and just the season that they put together, I would think that they're really not spending a whole, maybe many nights losing sleep over the fact that but haven't really tweaked the lineup very much.
Yeah, you wouldn't think so, given that they were second in the NL in runs this past year, and they still have guys, again, those guys that I mentioned that they feel will improve. And also you've got, A.J. Pollock, who's just now starting to kind of come into his own with a breakout season. David Peralta, who came out into his own last year. So I think that they're going to have Wellington Castillo behind the plate for a full year. So I think, offensively, they shouldn't be an issue for them. I think the allure of somebody like a Howie Kendrick or Brandon Phillips, who they discussed in the deal with the Reds, the only appeal there is that those guys have a more proven track record than some of the younger players. But, having that extra security or what have you, I don't think is worth it in terms of giving up that draft pick or the cost of Brandon Phillips in terms of his contract. Not so much for this coming year, but the year after that, the final year of his deal.
Yeah, you can't really predict exactly how seasons are going to go, even when you think that maybe you have a pretty good handle on how the season might go. And I just remember back when I was covering the Astros, the most boring spring trainings going into spring training, the most boring ones were when the team was just supposed to be really good. And so the only position battles were like fifth starter, a couple bench guys, maybe a backup catcher. And I just remember thinking to myself, wow, this is going to be kind of a rough spring for me, but probably a great season for the Astros, which is kind of how it turned out. And so when I'm looking at like the Diamondbacks, you're like, yeah, I'm kind of hoping to do maybe add a bullpen arm, nothing imminent. And then they just have to figure out the final two spots of but it should be a fantastic rotation. And looking at those options, there's some pretty good options in there. Wouldn't you say? I mean, these aren't just kind of throwaway names. I mean, these are guys that can really contribute. Chase Anderson, Archie Bradley. How do you think that might shake out?
Yeah, I think that's going to be the most interesting thing to watch this spring is, okay, so you pencil in Greinke and Miller and Patrick Corbin into the rotation, and then that's four and five spots. They do have a lot of guys to choose from. Ruby De La Rosa had a pretty good year last year, 14 wins, a little inconsistent, but still, nothing to be ashamed of. Chase Anderson had a nice year. He had a slump there in the middle portion of the year, but he's somebody that has some potential. Robbie Ray, a left-hander that throws hard. Archie Bradley, a former number one pick. So, Zach Godley, who pitched well for them last year. So they do have a number of different options. And I think you were right when you said this. I think anytime you're a team and you go into spring training thinking, we have three really quality starters and a number of options, so who's going to be our fourth and fifth starter? I think if that's all you're looking for, you feel pretty good going into spring training.
I feel like I'm putting together a puzzle, kind of when I'm researching the Rockies and making notes and trying to figure out what they're doing, because this all kind of makes sense. So we hear that they might be interested in Gerardo Parra, who is an outfielder, which wouldn't make any sense at all, except when you think about the fact that they could plug him into an outfield and then actually trade an outfielder to get pitching, and pitching is what they need. So do I have that right?
Yes, it's like a little Rubik's Cube here. You move one of the blocks somewhere, and another, you have to have another block to fill in, and you hope it's all color-coded when you're all done with it. That's exactly what's going on. They've made contact with Gerardo Parra, the free agent outfielder. He is one of them. I think that there are other guys on that list of outfielders, kind of the guys that are a little below the top tier salary-wise. So if they trade an outfielder, which seems to be what they're looking for because they have to improve the pitching, they decided they're not going to spend on the free agent pitching. So in order to do that, they have to trade an outfielder. And obviously if they trade one, they have to bring in one because they've got some prospects that are getting closer, but they're not quite there yet. So right now, in order to put a full outfield out there in 2016, they're going to have to go out and sign someone if they make that trade.
Right, and at the winter meetings, after they're over, my line is always, oh, it's still early. I know that everyone thinks that everything has to be done at the winter meetings, but there's plenty of time left in the offseason. And then, quite frankly, once the new year gets here, I'm thinking to myself, time is kind of running out. And, what are you waiting for, or you know, what's left? And so really, at some point, they're going to have to stop talking about it and start doing something, wouldn't you say?
I would think. Here's the issue, though. There are a number of free agent outfielders out there that are dragging this thing on, you know, taking the different offers, and that's the reason why this is happening. When you've got guys like Cespedes out there that are weighing a bunch of offers, then sometimes you have to see who is not going to get the guy they want and then go back to them and say, okay, now, hey, you may not have gotten the guy you want, but we've got the guy you need at $37 million as opposed to however many million you're going to spend on you know, one of the top guys on the market, you know, the Uptons, the Cespedeses, and even Chris Davis. So that's where that stands.
So is it encouraging at all? Oh, go ahead.
I say it's all tied together, and I'm seeing this as we go. It seems like each year something gets later, whether it's pitching or quite often it's the outfield or maybe it's a position like first base. It seems that if you have a number of players on the market and a number of teams with needs, it's almost like musical chairs, and you have to go through the whole negotiating with people before teams that may want to trade can make a trade. So this is something you don't see it a lot. Usually by the first of the year, you know, you have your team set. I mean, a number of teams are even announcing who they're inviting to spring training right now. But there are still these big pieces that are out there.
That's very true. I wanted to ask you just if it's encouraging, you know, from a fan standpoint, like the Rockies farm system has been called one of the more improved. Of all the teams. Of course, it's our Jonathan Mayo from MLB.com. Gotta give him a shout-out. But the Rockies farm system is definitely, like, on the rise, on the mend, whatever you want to call it. And I guess when you're trying to, I don't know if it is comfort Rockies fans, explain things to them, but that has to be a selling point for the Rockies. Like, hey, you know, we are developing some pretty good talent, and we're trying to make this whole thing kind of come together.
Yeah, I think when you look at the farm system and what they're building, they've built a number of pitchers that are kind of close to the major leagues. And also, there are some position players that are very good there. I mean, you look at in the outfield, David Dahl and Ramil Tapia. They're close. They're not quite major league ready yet, but it could happen this year. I'll tell you something, and I don't know if I've said it on this show or another, but there was a day during spring training, and you know how those spring training games get, where you get to the late innings and I like to say it's the tight ends and tackles out there. You know, guys with 70 and 80 numbers, and they're out there playing. They were playing the Dodgers one day, and the Dodgers had brought over a bunch of veterans. And here are these kids from Asheville. It's a low class A. And before the game, they all received their championship rings. And I remember talking to a couple of them beforehand, and it was the most exciting thing they'd ever done in their lives was getting their championship rings on a big league spring training field. They played that game as if it was the seventh game of the World Series. You know, the Dodgers were over there like, gosh, you realize this is spring training. But I go back to 2005 and 2006, so really about 2004 when you started to see a group of Rockies players play that way to the point where they all weren't future superstars, but you saw that they learned how to win together. Could the Rockies be developing that? That's what I feel like, is that it seems like the 2017, 18, 19 is when you're going to see this team mature. No one wants to hear that right now because you've got a season coming. But that's exactly what I'm seeing. And when Jonathan Mayo is seeing it also, and you know, he's not close to it and hearing about these guys every day, that says something to me. That I do think in a few years this is going to pay off for them, but right now there is pain.
I would agree with that. And I want to talk about Tyler Matzek. This is a very, I think, important topic and a very interesting topic. So you recently spoke to him, and he is being very open about what he's calling performance anxiety, which has hampered him in his past. So what did you glean from all of that, and what did he say about where he is right now from an emotional standpoint?
I think from an emotional standpoint, I think that what you can do at this point, because you never do know until you're on the mound, and you're pitching, and that guy is standing there in the batter's box. Maybe he's crowding the plate, or maybe there are guys on base. You really don't know until you get to that point. But what you want to do when you come out of what he went through, and it was performance anxiety. He ended up going to see a therapist with some expertise in sports. What when you're in those tight situations, you want to have something to go back to. When I watched him during the season, it's funny. Obviously, I didn't know about performance anxiety, and I certainly can't see into his mind. But he struck me as a guy who, when things got in trouble, he really didn't have something to go to. I mean, he had made it on a lot of natural talent, and I'm thinking maybe there's something fundamentally with his pitching that he missed along the line, and he can't diagnose what's wrong. So it turned out that maybe it was this mental thing. He had had a good year the year before, especially at the end of it, and just sort of pressed himself to be better, and things just sort of spiraled on him. At the end of last year, he was throwing some games in relief in the minors, so he's going to come to camp, try to win a starting rotation job. There could be room in the bullpen right now. There's a hole in the bullpen, to be honest with you, so why not? I'm hoping he does well, because you want to see someone be able to use their talents to the best of their abilities, and, hey, if the talent isn't there or it's no longer there anymore, then you can say, hey, I gave it all I had. But when something difficult like that is in the way, you would like for the guy to be able to overcome that and just get to the point of pure physical talent.